I'm Ann Nicholson Weber, and this is Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. This week, we're talking about the art of casting, and I have three people who have something to say on that subject. Erica Daniels, who is the director of casting and the school at Steppenwolf Theater. Bob Mason, who is the casting director at Chicago Shakespeare Theater. And Matt Miller, who is a casting director at TPNR Casting, which is a commercial casting agency?
Casting house.
So welcome to all of you. And I think that I'd like to start talking about this subject from the point of view of the actors, who obviously have a great deal invested in this process of how casting happens. Maybe we could start, Erica, you could talk about how your role as casting director interfaces with the role of the director of a show.
Sure. Primarily, it's my job to work extremely closely with the director, listening to what their vision of the play is and the types of actors they see in the various roles. I think if you've worked with a director more than once, you get to know what types of actors they respond to and their aesthetics, so you know who you might want to bring in and present to them. I always say it's my job to sort of lay out the buffet, and then they pick what dish they would want in combination. Steppenwolf is an ensemble theater, so we primarily start with ensemble members who may be appropriate for a role. So we'll start talking about them, and then we go beyond the ensemble and think about Chicago actors primarily. And we'll bring in, we'll talk about the script, we'll bring in about 10, 20 people per role to start at most. And depending on what the project is, if I'm looking for young adults, I may bring in many more before I even present them to the director. But we sort of, just run through the auditions with the directors there. And in the end, it's going to be the conversation between the director, myself, sometimes my artistic director, Martha Lavey's in the room. Really putting the puzzle together, and it's my job to lay out the knowledge I have about the individual actors. If I've seen them in a show, I often speak to my two colleagues here about actors and other theaters in the city, and try to get feedback on actors, and see a lot of theater, so I can speak from a place of knowledge about the person, and I know if they have the chops to do the role. And in the end, it's really the director who's going to have that final say. They're the ones in the room with those people rehearsing for, 4 to 6 weeks. And so in the end, the director makes the final decision. And so sometimes I watch a show and I say, okay, that's not how I would have gone in the end. And sometimes I'm pleasantly surprised to have somebody steps up. But, it's my job to really keep the director in check with what his needs are, to remind him what he or she articulated they wanted in an actor, so that they can pick the best person who most suits their vision for the play.
Well, once you've brought in the 10 actors for a role and you've seen them, and then you're saying you recommend some number of those to the director, or does the director see all 10 of those?
Usually, if it's like 10 actors, then the director's in the room with me. For a production like Anne Frank, where we were looking for young adults, I must have seen almost 1,000 young people before I brought 20 Peters, 20 Anns, 20 Margos in for the director. And then she narrowed it down with me to like 5 that she wanted to focus on. Unfortunately, that's why actors don't realize how hard it is to get in that top 5 list, because we really have to show the director the best. That doesn't mean that those 5 will be the ones. Then you go to the next level and the next level, and it's highly subjective, but you're working off of, past knowledge and history that you have with the director to try and gauge you.
Well, before I go to Bob or Matt, once the 5 have come in and the director has started to give you responses to them, do you push back? Do you say, well, actually?
I respond. I've been at Steppenwolf almost 8 years. So the relationship I have with my directors now is very different than the relationship I had, 7 years ago. 7 years ago, I kept quiet. I listened. Now I think they trust me to really give my feedback. And I push back a bit if I disagree with them, but it's not in nobody's going to come in for an audition if I don't think they can do the job. I may push back because of something that has completely nothing to do with talent, but has to do with budgets or contracts from out of town being used when I feel like we do have it in Chicago and I should just dig a little deeper and I want them to give me that time. Or I just want them to have some information about an actor and though that actor might be the best person for the role, I just feel like there's a piece of information that they should have about past knowledge I have about them, just so that they're prepared when they go in the room. But I think the harder sometimes you push against something, the more a director tends to want it. Exactly. I've learned that over time. Right. So you push it, you push only so far and then you just let it go, because in the end it's their play, it's their project. And very rarely do we get mentioned in reviews and credits as, the casting director has assembled a great cast. It's the director has. And sure. So if a problem occurs, we very rarely get the fall of the blame as well as the credits. So.
Right, right. Right. Well, Bob, would you have any different answer to that question?
No, Erica covered a lot of it. the one thing that's different for me than Erica Steppenwolf is that being a Shakespeare theater, if I'm working on a Shakespeare play or a play that's very heavily based in text, that becomes really one of the major things we look for. But again, it depends on the director, because every director has a different way they like the text being spoken. And usually you always have that scary first day with a director when you don't know them. And you watch people come in and you see who they respond to and say, oh, she likes this person. They speak the text in a very visceral way. Or a director will like people who speak the text very cleanly and clearly. And so the second and third day becomes more important, because I'd start bringing in people that seem to reflect their sensibility. So that's a really important thing about what I look for. And I really, more and more look not in Chicago, but all over the country, because we are trying to find, it's a very specific skill. And I always say that you can have a really good actor who doesn't necessarily know how to be text-based and focus on the language, the same way that you can have an excellent dancer who can dance on point, but they can't tap dance. And there really is an analogy that they're a good dancer, but they're not necessarily a good dancer in that medium specifically.
Matt, is there anything, obviously you have quite a different job to do since you're doing commercial.
Sure.
Casting.
In the commercial world, I often don't get the benefit of actually talking with the director before I have to start my process. So that's one of the big differences, I would say, is that oftentimes I'm flying based on my knowledge of whatever product it is that the commercial is for. Say it's for Gatorade, I have to use my kind of schema for what I know Gatorade commercials generally look like and the type of talent that they generally put in those type of commercials. Because oftentimes I won't be able to have a conversation with the director before I have to start assembling my audition schedule. So part of it is, knowing a little bit about the product, trusting your instincts based on the script for the commercial and what kinds of talent they're going to be after. I have to go off of some very sparse notes sometimes. Woman, 35-ish, Caucasian. Mm-hmm. That is the basis.
That narrows it down.
Exactly. That's the basis from which I get to work sometimes.
But I would also say that Erica and I probably do the same thing, is that you find out what a director says they're looking for, and you bring in that. And then you bring in one or two that aren't that, mm-hmm. just to see mm-hmm. how they respond to it. Because I've had that happen where they've seen an actor and said, I didn't think this is what I wanted my play to be, but now mm-hmm. this is what I want my play to be because I want this actor in it. Mm-hmm. And they're going to totally change my perspective. So I think that's a part important yeah. part of our jobs as well, is not just listening to exactly what they want, but maybe what they also haven't thought of.
Well, that's interesting. Well, so Matt, the pool of people that you might bring in for a Gatorade commercial, are these always people that you've worked with before? Are they people who have auditioned for you separate from this particular commercial? What's the process?
Yes and no. It varies from project to project. For some projects where I'm looking for a face, or I'm looking, in the case of Gatorade, perhaps I'm looking for actors who have, some real defined musculature to their body, who look like runners, perhaps. That becomes my criteria. So I'm using headshots to base some of my decisions on. I'm talking to the agents and managers about who they represent, who fits these kind of criteria. And so it becomes less about their ability to speak, speak dialogue.
To act.
Exactly. And it's much more about Would I believe this person as a runner? I have, you know, and that's the big difference between just the kind of stories that I'm working on too. I'm working on 30-second stories as opposed to a play that takes place over 2 hours. And so I have literally 5 seconds to establish a character and make that character believable. So it's a much smaller margin of error in terms of an actor reading as a runner immediately in the commercial world.
I'd like to ask, are you often surprised when the actor comes in if you've only known them based on the headshot, that there's a discrepancy?
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest things I think about headshots is that they're often deceiving. And, you know, to the actors who might be listening to this, I think that's one of the biggest criteria is make sure your headshot really looks like you. It sounds like an odd thing to say, but
you on a good day, but not on the best day
exactly,
of your life.
Yes.
Because I had once where an actor, this beautiful headshot, looked very young and Italian. I thought, oh, what a great Romeo. Brought him in and he looked like he should be playing Eugene in Greece. He was the quintessential nerd, which is also a great type and something that's very useful,
right.
But he must get called
not
in for
Romeo.
A lot of roles that he doesn't get because his headshot was so misleading.
Well, that leads to a question that I'm sure actors would like you to answer, which is, you know, what are the things they shouldn't do and should do in an audition and in approaching casting agents? Maybe Erica, give us a pet peeve.
It's amazing when you say, you know, be prepared, be on time, know what you're auditioning for and have the correct material. And that sounds like such common sense. And yet it's amazing how many people walk into an audition and they're either 15 minutes late or they've come 2 hours early and they don't realize that actually, depending on what they're auditioning for, we may be doing things in certain categories. We may really have thought about who we're pairing you up with to help not just you, but to help our director see you in a certain way and see you with a certain, you know, combination of, you know, pretend family members. And so I think actors really, as the career goes on, it's as important to be as prepared that first, for that second audition that you've had for the day than your first audition, and to really get the material in advance and have the conflicts, you know, in your head, aware of, you know, am I available for the project even? Because it's not necessary for you to audition for any of us if you can't do the project. And those things stay in our minds a heck of a lot longer than if you, you know, went up on your monologue or didn't, you know, bring the extra headshot you need. If you're not available for things and you're wasting our time. And it's the interpersonal, I think, that actors get in their own way. They you know, roll their eyes at the end of the audition. They go up in a line and suddenly they curse and they don't realize that actually none of that makes a difference to us. But that's the stuff that really loses the job for them in the end, is seeing them comment on their own work. Or I don't want to be concerned about actors' mental state after the audition. I don't want to be removed from the audition. I want to think about them as the character from beginning to end. And I want them to be present from beginning to end. Many actors walk in and you ask them how they are and they say, you know, I'm good, thank you. And then you ask what they're doing and they go into what I call like monologue mode, and they suddenly reintroduce themselves in this very formal way and the piece they're doing. And I'm sitting there going, that was odd. We were having a really lovely conversation and then you turned into a robot. And I think they forget that people like Bob, Matt, and I are truly rooting for them behind the table. Nobody wins if we don't cast the play or the film or the TV show. If we have to keep bringing people in for a director, the director gets frustrated. Nobody is being successful in their jobs if we're not, you know, rooting for people. And so we truly want the experience to be positive, and we want people to feel good about themselves and do well. And it's not an us against them mentality in that room. And psychologically, I think actors really walk in thinking they don't have a chance, and therefore the cat ate my homework, I didn't get the sides, my pages aren't in order. And it's this self-sabotage that happens, as opposed to walking in knowing you're in the right place and knowing you have a shot at getting the job, and you're there because you're supposed to be there, and owning that 10 minutes or whatever it is, and being ready to do the work, listening and be responsive to what you're being given. And not being afraid to make some choices.
Bob, how about you? Would you have things to add to that list?
Conflicts is for me the biggest thing, is that you come in because maybe you want to be seen by a director, but the biggest way, the fastest way to have a director go from loving you to not liking you so much is for us to then find out you weren't available for the job and you only came in because you wanted this director to see you. Well, that does no one any good, especially if you're not upfront about it. I mean, if you're upfront and say, really, I'm not available for this job, could I be seen by the director anyway? Let us have that choice, just if we think it's someone that the director should know for the future. But that's a big thing with me. And also what Erica says, you hate it. I think all of us have somewhat acting in our backgrounds, and you hate to see an actor self-sabotage him or herself, where you see the whips and chains come out because they made a mistake. And it really is the way they've responded to the mistake that gives you more information, because you're not just casting talent, you're casting a company. And you don't want someone to be adding drama that's not on the stage. And it's a very, very important part of the casting process, is that you start learning, oh, this person is good, but they're going to be work, whereas this person is good and they're a pleasure to have around. Well, that second person is really going to have a leg up.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, Matt, is it a different calculus for you, or is it?
Oh, no, I would very much tack on to the conversation that's happening here. I think there's a really subtle form of actor self-sabotage that I see happen quite often, where it's I think it's a mechanism for actors to deal with the rejection that they encounter, yes, in this business with great frequency. And I think the mindset is, if I don't prepare, if I don't do my best, then the rejection is not as fierce, because I know that I could have done better. And I think that's unfortunately a very weak position to operate from as an actor. And I really encourage the paradigm, and I think this is partly just knowledge of the process too, that, you know, we have a tremendous problem. We have to find actors who are going to make these roles come to life and make the story work. And if actors, I think, realize that there is a problem, and that you as an actor offer a potential solution to that problem, that's a much stronger, I think, psychic position to hold, mm-hmm, as you head into that audition room, knowing that here is one way I could solve your problem for you. Here is what I can do that no one else can do. I think that's a much healthier outlook.
One of the worst things an actor can do is try to guess, what do they want? So often in the room, they're really not sure, or they want to see what you bring to it. And if you try to do what they want, you're really not presenting the best of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Something that, yeah, you can't really own. You're faking,
yes,
somehow.
And also, it's true that there's no such thing as a wasted audition. If you're great in an audition and you don't get cast, all that means is that we're going to find something else to call you in for.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
that's part of our job,
absolutely,
to remember if the director has responded at all. So a year down the road, you might get the call saying, well, Amy Morton remembered you from that audition. And it shocks actors. And it's, no, you were sensing that somebody was liking you in that room. It just wasn't for that role at that, mm-hmm, moment. But you have to, I think of the audition as the win and not getting the role as the win, because you do hear no thank you so much more in this business than, oh my gosh, you're the one for the role. And I think if you think, well, Bob is calling me in on a regular basis, I must be doing something right, because he wouldn't be calling you in at all if you were doing poor auditions. And I think it's just spinning the audition to the success. And that's all you have to do.
Well, I know it's a source of great frustration to actors that they're being judged on the basis of a 10-minute something. And that becomes the basis for a judgment about whether over 6 weeks of rehearsal working with other people over a long organic process, they could do something fabulous. How do you correct for that difference? Maybe Bob?
Well, I think part of it's what Erica had said earlier, is that you try to have as much information about them in performance as you can. Luckily, hopefully, having seen them in shows in Chicago, I mean, after a while, you start developing an instinct about people and where they can go. Even with Shakespeare, I've had actors come in where I think they're a really, really fine actor, don't have a lot of language experience, but I see that they seem to understand how to use the language once they're pointed in that direction. And then I'm always, you know, we need actors like this that are that bright and smart, that this person over rehearsal period is going to give you something really special.
Mm-hmm.
And you start just developing an instinct about that and really promoting those people.
So both, or maybe all three of you, are saying that you go to shows in Chicago, you see actors. How do you decide what to go see?
We talk to each other.
Yeah, we talk to each other. I read, you know, all the reviews, and if there's an actor I am unfamiliar with and they've gotten an excellent write-up, I get down there and see them right away, because nothing infuriates me more than when somebody gets a good review and I'm like, why don't I know who that is?
Yes.
And I very rarely, I mean, Bob knows this because I would obviously call him for tickets, but it's not like I run to Chicago Shakes. I'm running to see Amadeus because I really want to see that production. But we know a lot of the actors we each use in our big spaces. So I tend to spend, and I think Matt, you do also, I know, and Bob, I know you do. We tend to go to a lot of the smaller black box theaters to see new non-equity, non-union actors. I mean, I know who's working at Chicago Shakes, Steppenwolf and the Goodman. It's not necessary for me to run around seeing the big equity actors. Yeah. I know who they are.
Yeah, right now, Shaunaki is doing scenes from the big picture with 20 actors. That a lot of them are very young, and that's kind of, oh, thank you for putting them all together in one place for me.
I'm going tonight. Uh-huh. Bob went last week.
That's interesting.
It's, you know, that's what
you
we
know,
do.
For me, one of the big reasons why my clients come to Chicago to cast is they're looking for character actors and funny people. They're looking for people who've been through Improv Olympic, who've been through Second City. And so as a result, I see a lot of improv. I am pretty frequent at Second City and I.O. and see as many of those shows as I can, simply because I know that's a base of talent that my clients are very interested in tapping into. They're looking for you know, those people who have that kind of skill set, who have that kind of training, and can get on a set and are going to be able to play and have fun. So. And
that's one thing I think actors too need to think about, is not to limit themselves, because I know some actors don't submit to Chicago Shakespeare because it has Shakespeare in the title, and yet we do a lot of musicals. We do, we have association with Second City, having done some projects with them. We just did a rap production, Funk It Up About Nothing. So it really is, you know, think, I might be able to work at Chicago Shakespeare and not think about the Shakespeare as much.
And actors need to be aware of what theaters are doing, what projects at any given time, so that they can self-promote and do the marketing that's necessary, and that they can send a letter to Bob saying, oh, I understand you're doing such and such musical, or Matt, you're working on such and such project, or we're doing Shakespeare for the first time ever, you know, this year. And actors need to be able to put that in a cover letter, that's what they're trying to get in for, so that we can say, oh.
What's the best source of that kind of information for an actor to have enough lead time?
Whether it's each individual's theater's websites, the League of Chicago Theaters website that has links to all the different theaters, the trade magazines that are in town, like Perform Inc., and really just speaking to other and talking to other actors. I mean, it's such a tight – this community of actors is an amazing community, because they really do share their knowledge with each other, whether it's in a classroom situation or sitting in the waiting room at a, you know, audition for something. Talk to your peer group and find out what people are auditioning for. But every season, the theaters list, you know, what shows they're doing. We announce our shows, and knowing when our open, you know, general auditions are, that's the actor's responsibility to find out that information.
Yeah. Well, that takes me back to something you talked about earlier, which is the fact that the actors are talking to each other, you three and other casting directors are talking to each other. What kinds of things would you say in a conversation about a particular actor to each other? If you call, you know, Bob, if you call Erica, what are you asking?
Have you worked with this actor? What kind of experience have you had with the actor? I mean, a lot of times it's just to see what kind of person is, you know, I'm not familiar with them. You know, this is the feeling I get from them. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Is that, would you agree with that? It's really just, I mean, I think we've all been in those positions where we've been so taken by an actor in his audition and kind of jumped into the deep end with them. And then later wish maybe we hadn't jumped so quickly.
We didn't have enough information at the time. So, I mean, it's usually for a verification one way or the other, you know, are my instincts, it's just not sure of our own instincts and saying, well, Bob's name is on his resume as a teacher. Matt's name is on his resume as having cast or directed him. And you just make the call. It takes 5 minutes to really get that reference.
And it's not really a yay or nay, because I've had, you know, instances with actors where they were in a certain point in their career with the Chicago Shakespeare, and Adam called me from Goodman and asked about them, and then they had a totally different experience with the actor because they were more mature, and you know, they'd grown up a little bit, and they were willing to take that.
So you're talking both about personal behavior, I mean, sort of non-talent related, but how someone is, as you said before the interview, how well they'll play in the sandbox.
Yeah.
But are you also asking, you know, they have this quality, is that they, in this audition, they had a certain quality. Is that real? Does that hold up?
Or like, I really like them, but I couldn't quite tell if they have any funny in them. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen them have funny?
Yeah. You know? Sometimes it's a quality that you know the character needs to have, and you perhaps the audition material you used didn't bring that out of them, and you need to know, will they be able to get there? And if I do, I need to bring them back in with different material? Is there a way to get them there? Or you know what your director's like, and you want to make sure I'm not going to create some strange relationship in that room. You just want to make sure that the vibe is going to be healthy also sometimes.
Well, there's another phenomenon, which is just as in among musicians, there are those who can sight read anything. And that doesn't necessarily mean that their ultimate performance will be wonderful. I imagine there are actors who are really good at auditioning and who maybe don't go further. And conversely, there are wonderful, wonderful actors who are not good auditioners. So is that the kind of thing, another kind of thing you might ask? Is that one of the ways you correct for that? You said earlier that you talk to each other sometimes.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you know, certainly with actors that you don't have much context for, you know, actors who are new to town, actors who you are just kind of meeting and have only maybe had them into audition a handful of times. Certainly those are the questions that I think you call around and try to get some answers for. I think that's one thing to know as an actor in town, too, is that we talk to each other. I do call directors in town. I do call teachers that you've worked with and try to get a better sense for just who you are as a performer.
Well, let's talk earlier. One of you said, I think it was Erica, that a director may be looking for a particular type of actor. And I'd be interested to have you list some of the vectors along which you characterize actors, and what are the kinds of adjectives you're likely to use to characterize an actor, and that you might say, this director is looking for a fill-in-the-blank type actor. What are the ways you use to describe qualities of actors?
That's kind of a hard question.
I mean,
one thing about right now is we're doing a production of Edward II in our theater upstairs, and it's in Promenade, and Sean Graney is directing it, and Sean isn't, I would say, if there were a typical Chicago Shakespeare director, it wouldn't be Sean. I mean, he's very edgy. He's out there. And casting a play for him, there was that marriage of finding people who had language skills, but also people that are willing to go on that ride with him and would enjoy it. Because it's a different ride, because he's going to go into all these different areas. It's Promenade, so the audience is with you on stage. Can an actor deal with that? They have to not be an actor that needs to be in control of every moment. So I guess that would be someone who has an improvisational quality where things like that aren't going to faze them and they actually get excited by it. And they're willing to go in unusual places. The director may, you know, point them down that path.
Mm-hmm. We just cast a pilot that, the bare bones of the script was in place, but the director was looking for performers who were going to be able to flesh it out and, you know, improvise a little bit in the style of The Office, perhaps, and really make the script a little bit more than what it currently was. So we brought in people we knew who could do that, who have that kind of background in performance, and he ended up with a great cast of, you know, mostly local comedians and improvisers who do that every week, go on stage without a script and create a 45-minute show. So that was a skill set that we were looking for specifically for that kind of project. But that's something that very frequently comes up in my world, is we're looking for performers who will be able to, to play with the language, to play with the characters, and really, make it a little bit more than what it currently is.
Mm-hmm. What is the art of the casting director? What makes you good at what you do? What kind of a person is good at being a casting director? Are there qualities that you all three share, you think?
We like actors.
Yes.
I think that's a big part of it, is that we genuinely like actors. We genuinely like
want them to succeed.
We want them to succeed. We like what we're doing. And the puzzle piecing creative side of this is, I think, what brought me into it, as opposed to sort of the business end of this, you know, career. I like puzzle piecing, mm-hmm. and solving the problem that Matt was talking about.
There's nothing more satisfying than reading a script and having immediately a few actors jump to mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't read a script without it happening.
And then when those actors ultimately get the role, that's really satisfying when you're able to have that kind of initial impression of who these people should be, and you bring them in for your director and your director loves them. And that's great. That's a great feeling.
But it is, I love that you called this the art of casting, because I really do think when it's done well, it can make or break a production when it's done. You know, it's I've seen shows that I've sat back and said, you know, the play's not that great. The, you know, direction was a little off, but man, they had some good actors up there.
Yeah.
And I think it really can make a script just come to life when there's this rich ensemble of actors, whether it's one actor by themselves or whether it's, you know, 25. Mm-hmm. I think it is an art of, because what people don't realize is behind the desk, we are there talking about the financials and the budgets and
who can
equity
in the
versus
cast.
The non-equity and internal understudying. I mean, it is a bigger puzzle than what somebody not in the know, you know, doesn't realize.
Imagine, right?
And it is. Mm-hmm. It's just.
And I think for us too, it's being open to those people we don't know or never thought of in a certain way and say, well, let's give this person a shot. I mean, it's exciting for me when someone will come in who hasn't worked at Chicago Shakespeare. You know, certainly don't think of them as a classical actor, and we're looking for something very specific, and they nail it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's great, because all of a sudden they're not in this box they were in before. And I think the great thing about Chicago theater and the actors is that they can do so many different kinds of genres in Chicago. There's so many, you know, from Kabuki to Miller to Mamet to Shakespeare, just physical theater. It's all at their disposal.
Mm-hmm. How much do you try to anticipate the chemistry between members of the cast? In other words, you're not just doing a one-to-one correspondence, this person for that role and this person for that role, but these two people will have to act together. Is that part of your calculation, or do you just expect that that will happen in rehearsal?
I think it's a little of both. Yeah. I mean, I don't dwell on it unless I know there's a history, like they were married, they're going through
yes,
it.
That has happened.
That happens. Things like that, you really do. Or, you know, I know they did a show together and they really don't get along. Their process is completely different. I mean, it depends on what their relationship in the play is and what their relationship in, if that mirrors the relationship in life in some strange way, you know, then I worry about it. Otherwise,
most directors I know don't really care about having people read together. The only difference is usually when I cast Romeo and Juliet, it helps to see the chemistry there, because it really can affect the pairing that you get.
I mean, I know in film, people talk a lot about the chemistry between two stars, and two really fine actors can truly not have it, whatever that mysterious quality is. But it sounds like that's something that you kind of trust can happen if the two actors are each really right for the roles. Is that right?
Well, I think when it's a romantic relationship, it tends to have a more needy, you know, put more weight on it. Like, will we believe that they love each other? Will we believe they love each other so much they'd, you know, kill for it?
Mm-hmm. If it's that kind of a relationship that's pivotal, generally the director will do a callback where he'll match up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've done some films where that certainly has happened, and some TV shows where it's been important to see how these two people behave together. And there's one actor they really like, and there's three or four different you know, people they could be paired up with. And so you do a little bit of that, you know, matching process.
I mean, I'm lucky that I know that, you know, Ron DeReed and Fran Guinan have amazing chemistry based on the relationship they have at Steppenwolf. So I am lucky in that a lot of the people I go to for some of the heavy lifting have, you know, they've had history and they have repeatable relationships and they do work that well together. The shorthand is there. But that's, you know, you see that in film, why certain actors repeat, you know, Diane Lane and Richard Gere right now come to mind. They're doing their third film together, and it's because for some reason people buy their chemistry together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they get along, and, you know, sometimes you just take a chance.
Yeah.
No.
More, I think we probably cast for the chemistry of the whole play. Mm-hmm. Do all these people seem like they fit into the same world?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you would say to an actor who's thought they nailed something, did a great job in an audition, and don't get cast? What are your words of wisdom for that person?
They probably did nail it. They probably did a beautiful job. And what is the sad part is that sometimes the decisions are made not based on talent, but based on a lot of other factors. And they need to walk out of there. And if something went wrong, learn from it. And if something went fantastically, then walk away and go, I did what I had to do, and let it go, not personalize it.
Absolutely. I remember when I was an actor, I would get the auditions that I always thought I did the best in. I wouldn't get the job. And the ones I thought, oh, I can't play this part. I'm terrible. And I'd get the offer. I mean, and it just sometimes that's yeah. just the way it works. But it really is enjoy your time in the room. I always say it's your chance to do what you want to do more than anything in the world. You get to act for 5 minutes. So embrace it. I mean, it's hard because that's just the kind of business it is. There's so little control for the actor.
And so much rejection.
Yes. Yeah. So they just have to keep on finding opportunities for themselves so they can do it more and more. And if you have a hard time auditioning and find that's really the thing that gets in your way, take a class because it is a totally different skill than rehearsing and being in a play. There are things you want to do in your audition monologue that you make choices you might not make if you had the whole 2 hours to present this character in a play. And you should learn what some of those things are so you get better at it.
Yeah. And not to be afraid of us. I mean, I think that's the dynamic that people gain from taking, whether it's a class or just listening to a podcast, they realize, wow, they're human. Wow, you know, they're rooting for me.
Though Matt is very scary.
I am freakishly tall.
But And it is. It's the hardest business anyone will ever do. You know, it's just you have to truly love doing this and wake up every day having to do it.
We're very lucky because we get to still be in the arts and be creative because casting is such a creative art form.
But nobody's going to say, nope, don't want you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.